You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about what happens in your brain when you meet up with an ex.
First, this weekend, a new program debuted in Wisconsin that gives crime victims confidential addresses. The program is called Safe at Home.
The program was created by a law signed a year ago by Governor Scott Walker. The law had the support of both parties and Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel.
He joins us now to talk about this program and what it does for Wisconsin crime victims. Attorney General Schimmel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, what is the Safe at Home program?
Well, you know, from 2.5 decades of working as a criminal prosecutor, I know that there are many in this state who are living in fear that a past abuser or someone who has direct abuse against them might find them. And so the Safe at Home program is an opportunity for those victims of actual or threatened domestic abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse, stalking, or trafficking, gives them the opportunity to have a legal substitute address, but they can still be reached, because what will happen is the Department of Justice will receive the mail that's going to the substitute address, and then we will forward it out to their actual address within a day or two. So it's an opportunity for them to feel safe in their home, and that's something that it's worst-case scenario, that someone who's been the victim of abuse or threats can't feel safe anywhere, even in their own home.
Can you talk a little bit about how this program was born here in Wisconsin?
Well, we actually joined 35 other states that have a similar address confidentiality program. But unlike most of the other states, ours also requires both public and private entities to enter into this, to use this participant's assigned address. This really came from a movement that was born from the advocacy groups like the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, and then victim advocates in the DA's offices who have worked with many survivors of abuse who have needed some type of protection from their abuser.
And I know that along the way, stories of some of the victims were persuasive. What kinds of stories did you hear?
Well, you know, I think of a story that I worked with in my own experience as a prosecutor when we had a young mother who her husband was away, and her apartment was invaded by a burglar who sexually assaulted her, threatened to harm her and more particularly harm her baby if she cried out. Well, after the fact, she was convinced there were two people there, but we didn't immediately identify the stranger who assaulted her. And during the time while we were trying to do that, she lived in terror that the person was going to come back and get her again for having contacted the police, because he threatened her that if she did contact police, he would come and get her and harm her and her baby. So during the time that we were working to identify the offender, she kept moving. And when we did finally get a DNA test that linked us to the offender who was ultimately convicted, we actually had difficulty finding her because she was in such fear that that the person would find her again if she had any public information as to where she lived.
And did you end up catching both of the perpetrators?
There was only one, and we'd always believe that from the circumstances of the case, we did catch him and ultimately convict him after trial. And he was a serial rapist that had committed a virtually identical act down in the Nashville area in Tennessee.
We're talking with Attorney General Brad Schimmel right now, joining us to talk about a new program just started in Wisconsin that gives the victims of domestic violence confidential addresses. And if someone is interested in taking part of this program, what do they need to do? How does it work?
Well, they can get access to the program by going through the DA's office that might be handling their charges. They can do that through any of the violence shelters that they might be working with, or they can find more information at www.safeathomewi.gov, and that's our website that will provide them all the information they need and a contact number where they can speak with a human being who will give them advice to get through this.
Are there other circumstances under which the state or a local governance entity would release their address?
We would do that only in very rare circumstances. Usually it would take a court order, and we may reveal it to law enforcement under, for certain official purposes. But generally, no. It's even for voting, that individual. And there was already a system in place to be a confidential voter in Wisconsin if you were a person like this. But now this builds in a structured system for how that's going to function. And so we've worked closely with the Elections Commission to make sure that this is going to work seamlessly for them. We've worked with the court system, because in court cases is another place where offenders can sometimes find contact information for their victims. So we've worked closely with them, with the Division of Motor Vehicles, with school administrators, and law enforcement. So they're all ready to hit the ground running with this.
Now, you mentioned 30-some other states that have similar programs up and running. Do we know from looking at those states how effective this kind of program has been?
You know, I know that in the state of Iowa, they had nearly 200 people sign up in the first year. We expect those kind of numbers here, too. That, you know, I had a number of these cases I knew of when I was in the Waukesha DA's office. And I wasn't the only prosecutor there, and I know that statewide, DAs that had these experiences, all of them have had these experiences with victims who have a significant need to have their address be confidential from potential abusers.
Now, is there any kind of proof, say, or corroboration that someone might have to go through to be part of the program?
We're trying to be very careful about not screening people out or making people reluctant to contact the program. There's going to have to be some basic level of credibility or basis to conclude that the person is a victim of abuse or a threat of abuse. But it's not a terribly high standard.
Now, it sounds as though the state has taken measures working with schools, working with the DMV, and collaborating on keeping this information confidential. What about information that's online from websites? I'm sure you've come across them as well, where you just plug in someone's name and then oftentimes an address pops up. Is that something that should be looked at too?
Absolutely. And as a person is set up into the program, we'll be changing. Presumably, they'll be moving to a new address that's not the same as the old one that the abuser was aware of. And as they move to their new address, we'll assign this confidential address, and that's what hopefully will end up on any online resources where a person might be trying to locate them.
Are there any other measures that Wisconsin might want to look at down the road to keep victims of domestic abuse, stalking, trafficking safe?
We're always working to find ways to determine which cases are the ones that create the highest risks. And Milwaukee County, for instance, has had a very successful program where they're identifying risk factors that have proven to be very reliable. And we're looking to spread that kind of work statewide. DOJ actually has a half dozen prosecutors that we've placed in regional DAs, the DA's offices in different regions around the state to help making determinations as to which domestic violence, which sexual abuse cases are the ones where we have the most to fear from abusers, that they will act again and act worse.
And finally, I want to ask you about another item in the news as we wrap up. Critics, including Democratic Representative Katrina Shanklin at last week's budget committee hearing, have said that the Department of Justice isn't doing enough to address a backlog of untested sexual assault evidence or rape kits. What is your response to those critics?
Well, first off, it's not a matter of there being a backlog. The kits that we're talking about have been accumulated for several decades. The Wisconsin Crime Lab now for quite a few years has been current on all current ongoing investigations. They test 800 to 900 sexual assault kits every year. What's happened is over the years, police departments and hospitals have held on to sexual assault kits for a number of reasons. Oftentimes, it's because the victim did not want to participate in the criminal justice system, and this evidence has been collected from their bodies. Therefore, we don't have any right to test that without their consent. So the program we've initiated has that built in, that we seek their consent before we go forward. In many cases, the person confessed, or consent was never the issue, so no one ever submitted the kit for testing because it wasn't necessary to prove that case. But over the course of the last 3 years or so, we started to recognize as a criminal justice system in America that there is a good reason to test those kits anyway, because we know that many, if not most, sex offenders are serial offenders, and they have more than one victim. So that's why we're moving forward to start testing these. But DOJ didn't create a backlog here, and we're not struggling with a backlog. What we're doing is we're going back and now taking a second look at old cases. And we've moved forward with this initiative as fast as we practically can. We completed the process of putting together the inventory, which was the first step required by a granting authority. We did that in just under a year, which is actually about as quick as it can go. It required us to hire people who went out and got in contact with all 550 law enforcement agencies in the state, went through all of the accumulated kits, conducted an inventory, but then also went through the police reports associated with each of those kits and prioritized which kits should first go for testing, which ones created the highest potential that we would find additional evidence that could help solve an unsolved case.
Attorney General Schimmel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
That was Brad Schimmel, Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin, joining us there to talk about a new program just started in Wisconsin that gives the victims of domestic violence confidential addresses. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, after a student was arrested for fighting in the lunchroom, we'll find out why Madison community members want to keep police out of schools.
First, meeting up with an old flame can send you on a roller coaster of emotions, depending on how your relationship evolved or devolved.
Our next guest talked to top scientists and researchers about what happens in your brain when you reconnect with an ex, just as she was getting together to catch up with an old boyfriend.
Amy Potterill joins us now to talk about her recent Discover magazine piece about what happens when you reconnect with an old flame. She's a health writer based in California. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what made you want to write about this?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what I expected when I first saw, you know, when I first decided to meet up with him again. But I knew that I had this desire to meet up with him again, despite the fact that our relationship ended, you know, not necessarily, most relationships end not on a good note. So, but I was curious about why I felt comfortable with him, you know, and once I saw him, I'm like, I have to investigate this. I have to figure out what is happening in the brain that would make you feel comfortable and at ease with somebody that, you know, you were intimate with years ago, but hadn't really had any connection with a relationship since then, and to see why you felt kind of connected still. I think the same sort of thing can happen with an old girlfriend, too, or an old, you know, just an old friend. And it's because of how information, it's how your brain is more open to receiving and preferentially encoding information in those younger years, the same way a child, you know, is more equipped to learn a second language, because our brains are like sponges during that period when it's still maturing. And it's still maturing up until our mid-20s. So my relationship with this person started in my early 20s, so it kind of made sense in that regard.
And you name this person Ben in your story. That's not his real name. What was this relationship like for you? How much did you bond, and how, you know, what mark did it make in your life?
Well, I think we connected at a time when I was pretty vulnerable and pretty young and naive about relationships. And so we had this really great connection, really great chemistry. We had a great relationship together. We were together for several years. And he sort of helped me overcome some personal demons, and I think I did the same for him. And I think together we sort of developed our template for what love looks like or what a relationship should be like. And so it was a really, you know, it was a great first relationship. Well, I shouldn't say first relationship. I had a high school relationship previously, but it was the first, like, real love relationship that had potential to be a lifelong type partnership, I think.
And how did it end?
So it ended, it's interesting. We were on the path to, we were engaged and getting married, and then, you know, we had sort of like a, I think he was not ready to get married and start a family, and we sort of just wanted different things. And but it didn't ultimately end until I discovered he had cheated on me. And that's, for me, there was no turning back from that. Like, I, even if I knew he would never cheat again and he promised to never cheat again, I knew I wouldn't be able to trust him, and that lack of trust would sabotage the relationship. So instead of giving him a chance to sort of change my mind, I kind of was like, okay, that's it. And, you know, and I ended the relationship and tried to cut off contact altogether. He kept trying to reach out to me, but I just, after that point, after I found out, I never looked back. And I never told him that I knew. So when we, you know, years later, we would periodically, you know, email each other over something. But that would, you know, there was a very long period of time before we actually even casually connected after that.
We're speaking with Amy Potterill, health journalist based in California, talking about her recent piece in Discover Magazine, talking about what happens in your brain when you meet up with that old flame. And Amy, one thing that kind of puts it all in perspective is that what happens is similar to what happens when a mother bonds with a baby, this kind of wash of chemicals that get reinforced. And before you know it, you have the, it sounds like sort of these grooves in your brain that a template, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's fascinating because there's a couple of things going on. So, you know, a love relationship is exciting. A new love interest is exciting. It can be actually intoxicating to be around that person. Researchers like Helen Fisher describe it like an addiction. It's like it triggers that dopamine center, that dopamine system in our brain that tells you this is a pleasurable experience I want to repeat over and over again. And then with a love relationship, you're adding this oxytocin, which you referred to as like the mother-child bond, this bonding chemical that is released during hugging, affection, physical orgasm, anything like that. That all floods your brain with oxytocin. And that's what creates this bonding. And so you can see why that would kind of be difficult to forget or to write off or to, you know, especially if it's occurring during this time when your brain is still maturing. Your brain remembers those things more acutely. So that's kind of what goes on.
Did you, because you were like role-playing your story, this was happening to you in your story, did you kind of feel that chemistry again when Ben walked into the restaurant?
It was this instant, like, instant knowing. It was very comfortable, very easy. And, yes, there was a lot of excitement, a lot of, you know, the heart-pumping butterfly thing. You haven't seen this person, or I hadn't seen this person in 15 years. So the whole unexpected element, like, how is this going to go, is another thing that triggers your dopamine system. It's kind of like when somebody is gambling. Like, you don't know what you're going to get. And so that excitement, it was completely flooding my system. And then, you know, you give the guy a hug, and, of course, there's oxytocin at the same time. So, yeah, mm-hmm. It made sense. I mean, by no means was it like, oh, I want to get back together with this person. But it was very intoxicating, I'll put it that way, you know, exciting and intoxicating.
Well, and there's a cautionary. At the end of your piece, there's this gray box, which is filled with cautionary words about how if you're thinking about reconnecting with that old flame, maybe via Facebook, you should probably think twice, because unless you're married, unless you're single, yeah. Widowed or divorced, the odds are they're not great that you're going to stay faithful to your partner when you do this. Can you talk about why that is?
Yeah, that's true. I think what's interesting, there's a woman, Nancy Kalish, and she studied this among early loves and them getting back, you know, connecting. And, you know, I think something like 60% ended up having an affair, a huge number. So you can see why there's this draw to that person. I think for me, like, I knew I had zero interest in getting back together with this person, so it was very safe. And I was also very happy in my current relationship. My life, I think when you meet up with an ex, you want to be in a place in your life where you're very settled and very happy and you're proud of who you are and what you've accomplished. And I went into this meeting that way. So, and I was happy in my relationship. So there wasn't a risk for me. And I did talk to a researcher who said, you know, if you are considering meeting up with an ex and you are happy in your relationship, getting back together with that ex, because it releases this flood of hormones, could actually make your current relationship even better, which it did. Like, I went back to my hotel room and texted my husband, you know? Mm-hmm. So it can go either way, but it's definitely a cautionary note to people who are maybe, you know, they're reaching out to this person for a reason that is, you know, wanting to feel those feelings again. If they are not single, it can end poorly for everybody. Because we also tend to look at those early relationships with rose-colored glasses. You remember all the good things and not so much the challenges.
So did Ben know you were writing an article and he's going to be in your piece?
He didn't, but he knows that I write about pretty much everything, so I'm sure he will see it at some point. And him and I at this point are very... you know, it's an easy relationship. So I'm sure he wouldn't be surprised and he wouldn't have a problem with it.
So based on the evidence, excuse me, your experience, what advice do you have?
You know, again, I think that before anybody reads it, today it's a very different world. It's much easier to track down a high school or college flame, and that can be tricky. So again, if you are thinking about that person, I had a researcher, Justin Garcia, at the Kinsey Institute. He put it really well. I think the take-home message is it's not abnormal or bad or wrong if you're having these feelings or thinking about somebody that you were with when you were younger. It's actually this intricate brain system at work, and it's nothing to be ashamed of or worried about. But it's the action behind it that matters. And if you don't trust yourself in that scenario, then you should not be reaching out to this person.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
That was Amy Potterill, health journalist from California, talking about her new piece in Discover Magazine, looking at what happens in your brain when you go ahead and you reconnect with that old flame. And you can find a link to her article on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we hear about the community outcry after a Madison student was arrested for getting into a fight in the school lunchroom. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7 o'clock, it's Reveal. Investigators dig up an unidentified murder victim 45 years after she was buried in an attempt to give her back her name. This leads to a series of unexpected revelations about who she was and why she may have been killed. Her case speaks to the complexity and importance of opening up cold cases. That's tonight after 7 o'clock on Reveal on the Ideas Network.
First, a Madison High School student is facing criminal charges after she got into an altercation at school over a week ago. 17-year-old Ariana Connors was in a fight that police say involved several other students. She was arrested on a tentative charge of physical abuse to a child.
The charges against Connors has some community members outraged. In a press conference in front of the Dane County Courthouse last week, groups like the Focused Interruption Coalition called the charges excessive and unnecessary.
They also called for the removal of Education Resource Officers, or EROs, who are police officers based inside schools. People who oppose having EROs have often argued that it leads to disciplinary issues being managed by law enforcement.
Joining us now to tell us more about the controversy around Connor's arrest is Khalif Mouabel. He is the executive director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring and a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration in Madison. Khalif, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jason Nance is also with us. He's an associate professor of law and has written about police officers in schools. He's also the associate director for education, law, and policy at the Center on Children and Families at the University of Florida. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Khalif, let's start with you and to focus here for a moment on Ariana Connors' case. Why do you think Connors' case was mismanaged?
It was a lot of underlying factors that leads us to that. I know the Focus Interruption Coalition, who I'm one of the leaders of the Focus Interruption Coalition, this case came to us early on. And we were just really outraged at the whole setup. And we were, the first thing came to my mind was the school to prison pipeline and the mismanagement of these juveniles being treated poorly like adults. And that just didn't sit with us well. First and foremost, Ariana is an avid top student. Not that makes much of a difference as to whether or not she is now or wasn't. The treatment is still the primary factor. But the thing is that she has a whole bright future ahead of her. The ERO that was said to make these charges was also one of the people who was one of the relatives of one of the girls that were involved in this fight. So there's a clear conflict of interest right there. I think her niece was involved. The ERO's niece was involved in this particular altercation. The other thing is that the 16-year-old that Ariana was defending herself against, Ariana was attacked. And the girl that she was defending herself against also received a lot of different charges in juvenile court, of course. But she was charged with assaulting an officer and all kind of other charges, battery, a lot of different charges for juvenile court. And my thing is this, when we talk about EROs, there's absolutely, in a day that we live in now, where there are evidence-based practices, this is the big thing. If you want to get funding for a program, the first thing they want to know is where is the evidence that this thing could possibly work? And even if you can't prove that it works, is there any kind of study that can show that it has potential to work? EROs has quite the opposition. It's quite to the contrary, because it's been proven that the EROs in the school doesn't work. In addition to that, there is no specific benefit for the EROs in the schools. And the police being targeted, they target us in our communities, in the black community. We're targeted. They are occupying forces in our communities. And when we have these same occupying forces in high schools occupying that space, it creates a tension between our young black babies and those police. And so there is a clear recipe for disengagement. And when you think about disengagement, there are other things that they're going to engage in. And there's also going to create that tension and that resistance and all of that, that's going to impact that environment in ways that sets it up for the school to prison pipeline.
Jason, you study EROs, these police officers in schools. What does your data tell you?
Well, I conducted an empirical study that was published in the Washington University Law Review in 2016, and I analyzed restricted data from the U.S. Department of Education, specifically the School Survey on Crime and Safety, and I was able to get access to a restricted version. And essentially what I did is I examined what effect of having having regular contact with an ERO has on the odds of referring students to law enforcement for committing certain offenses at school. And what I found is that even after controlling for things like school disorder or crime at school, neighborhood crime, reporting requirements that mandate that students be sent to law enforcement for committing certain offenses, as well as other school characteristic and student demographic variables. And I found that having a regular contact with an SRO was predictive of greater odds of referring students to law enforcement for all types of offenses, and that includes higher level offenses such as physical attacks with a weapon or threats with a weapon. But even more concerningly, it was also predictive of greater odds of referring students to law enforcement for lower level offenses, such as what happened in this case, a fight, vandalism, maybe a threat without a weapon. And that's particularly concerning to me.
Yeah. We're talking right now with Khalif Moab El. He's the executive director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring and a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration. Also with us, Jason Nance, associate professor of law, and who has been writing about having police officers in schools. He is at the University of Florida. They're joining us to talk about the role of ERO EROs in schools. And also Khalif has been addressing a recent case of Ariana Connor, who was she had an altercation in the lunchroom and then basically was arrested and charged for a series of crimes.
Yeah. So there are even greater issues here as it pertains to EROs in schools. I know that it's really easy for the school to call the police if there was a existing need for law enforcement to be present there on the scene. They could come within 5 minutes. That's number one. Number two, we're talking about $400,000 that's being gutted from the educational budget. And we're talking about schools that are already under-resourced, underserved, and that has very little diversity in the schools as well. So without there being in a need for these occupying forces to be there, I mean, it's poor spending. It's a misappropriation, in my opinion, of taxpayers' dollars. And what are we really doing? What kind of message are we really sending to children? I mean, as far as the likelihood of success, I mean, I don't know what kind of message that sends. Because if you're thinking police, the communities that I come from, when I think police, somebody did something wrong. So if I see police on corners, they're saying that this is a bad neighborhood, this is a bad environment. And if I see that force every single day, at some point, I'm going to have contact with that force. I mean, subconsciously, I'm already having contact with that occupying force. Every single time I wake up and walk out of my house, I see that police or police officers in general. And it doesn't create a feeling of ease for me. It creates tension. It creates anxiety. It creates all of those things that make me feel displaced. And so when you have that same kind of you leave the community with having to face with being faced with, I'm living in a bad environment, the odds are stacked against me, and then you go into a school and those same things are reaffirmed for you. I just think that that's just classic for failure for our children. And I mean, we have a demographic of teachers. It's about 75% or a little bit less than 75% of those teachers are white women. And we have very little diversity. If we do have diversity, the diversity is very limited. We have very little cultural competency, very little training exercises to really engage our children of color and that kind of thing. And we're wasting money on EROs, occupying forces in school, instead of trying to find ways to enrich the potential likelihood of success for our children. I just think that those values are backwards.
So, Jason, what does the data say about the relationship between EROs and students of color?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. What we've seen is that, just as Khalif was describing, is that EROs many times are not very well equipped to interact with students that are different from them. So, for example, students with disabilities, minority students, maybe LGBTQ students, they don't receive very much training regarding how to de-escalate and how to appropriately interact with these individuals. What is, I think, concerning is that because of the lack of training, you can see how they handle situations that I think should be handled differently. So, for example, in its investigation of Ferguson, Missouri, the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, the U.S. Department of Justice, they determined the following, that they determined that, this is a quote from their statement, that SRO's propensity for arresting students demonstrates the lack of understanding of the negative consequences associated with such arrests. For example, they told the Department of Justice they were proud of their arrest rate. They viewed that as a positive result of their work. And so this shows a lack of training and a lack of understanding regarding the very negative consequences associated with involving a student in the justice system.
I remember in my high school there was an ERO, and I'm going to date myself, but this is back in the 80s, early 90s, but this was a plainclothes police officer. It wasn't someone in uniform. Does that matter at all, Jason, whether the person is wearing a uniform or not?
I'm not sure if it matters, or I think that it would matter if the students are aware of the police officer being there and the purpose for the police officer. I think that tends to matter more. Khalif was talking about some of the, you know, positive things and the negative things associated with having it. I view this as sort of a cost-benefit analysis. And what they're wearing, I don't think makes as much of a difference. Maybe they're trying to blend in a little bit more. But they would, the communities and the schools would say, okay, we're trying to build relationships of trust with the students. We're trying to make campuses safer. But as Khalif was explaining, is that trust can be damaged, I think, many times as police officers continue to mishandle these events. And there's questions regarding whether or not having a police officer there at on campus actually creates a safer environment. So the positives are in question. And then we have a lot of negative things, as Khalif was mentioning. They're very expensive, that they contribute to this very intense surveillance environment that damages trust. And now we have students, more students that are being involved in the justice system. And so like Khalif, I think that the negatives do outweigh the positives in many instances, no matter what, you know, they choose to wear.
We're talking about a controversy in Wisconsin after a Madison High School student was arrested and is facing criminal charges for getting into a fight in the school lunchroom. And we're hearing from Khalif Mu'ab El, a speaker on mass incarceration and racial justice issues in Madison, and Jason Nance, an associate professor of law who studies police presence in schools.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with our guest? Do you think students should face criminal charges for fighting in schools? Is having school police officers or EROs good for students? Why? Or maybe why not? And if you work in the justice system or in the schools, we'd love to hear from you. Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing the conversation about police in schools with Khalif Mu'ab El and Jason Nance. Khalif is a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration issues based in Madison. And Jason is an associate professor of law at the University of Florida. And he's written about the impact of school police officers or EROs.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of having school police officers or EROs? Do you think the presence of law enforcement in schools has a disproportionate effect on communities of color? And if you have kids in school or remember your own school days, tell us whether or not you would want law enforcement involved in the case on a fight. Call 800-642-1234.
And let's take a call right away. Let's go to Sandra in Elkhorn. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, when I was going to high school, we had the officers in plain clothes, and, you know, we did have a bunch of altercations that happened at our school. But the reason why I agree that we should have these officers in there, because it's not the lack of, you know, with the presence of the police officer, it's how parents are taking care of their kids. They are so relaxed on taking care of their kids that kids don't have respect for their elders anymore. And the reason why I say that is because my aunts, I've got several aunts that work in the school district, and I had one of my aunts end up getting several broken ribs and a broken jaw because a student got upset that somebody took his pen, and my aunt tried calming him down, and the next thing my aunt knows is this kid gets pissed off, and he turns around and he hurt my aunt. I've dealt with situations where you see these kids that are getting violent. Look at the YouTube videos that show these kids are going after teachers, disrespecting them, yelling at them, causing these, you know, big altercations by throwing stuff. And a lot of the, like, seniors in high schools, these boys, you know, throw their weight around. And without these officers there, they're there to protect not only the students, but the staff as well. I mean, it's not just the violent issues, but these officers are there to help kids if they have a minor thing. There are so many girls that have been assaulted by other students, or they're, you know, unsure what's going on, or they come, you know, other kids come and say, hey, this is a concern I have, one about my friends. You know, is there any way you guys can look into this?
So I see what Sandra is saying. She, you know, has a very personal experience as well. And Khalif, how would you react to that and disrespect for elders?
Well, number one, I think a lot of these issues stem from parents not being able to maintain their households. But when we're talking about parents not being able to maintain their households, we're looking at punitive alternatives for these parents. But these are parents who live in single parent households, work 2 to 3 jobs to take care of 5 or 6 children. And we're talking about an impoverished environment where these children are coming from. The Supreme Court has already stated that studies have shown that it takes about 25 years for a person to mature adequately. And that means that they at that point that they develop some kind of a culpable state of mind where they're able to appreciate the wrongfulness of their behavior. So right now we're criminalizing people. It's almost like criminalizing people that have mental illnesses. That's number one. Number two, I went to prison at 15 years old, and the presence of the police in my school caused me to drop out. And that caused me to become disconnected. That's number two. Number three, when we're talking about the issues around not being able to maintain and control the environment, you have school security that can do that. There are other alternatives to policing that could be employed inside of the school that could also minimize the environmental disruptions and things of that nature.
And Jason, and I'm going to step in there, you have actually argued that exact thing, that schools should learn to handle certain issues without the justice system. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a couple of things here. I think that following the tragedies that occurred at Columbine, the U.S. Department of Education, the U.S. Secret Service, they investigated 37 incidents of violence in schools from 1974 to 2000. So they were, very steeped in this. And they concluded the following. They concluded that in safe schools, this is what constitutes a safe school. It's where you have adults and students that respect each other, where you have positive personal role models in the faculty, you have places of open discussion where diversity and differences can be respected, where you have communication between adults and students that's encouraged, that conflict is managed and mediated constructively. Then you have another study that was conducted by Matthew Steinberg and his associates within the Chicago public school system, which also has had trouble as well. And they found that even in schools serving high concentrations of students from high poverty and crime areas, that it was the quality of relationships between staff and students and between staff and parents that most strongly define safe schools. And so what I would argue is that by putting the police officers in schools, I think that that's the wrong solution, that's not what really creates safe environments. What creates safe environments are where you have positive school climates. And there are many different initiatives out there, evidence-based initiatives that work very well, that we've seen a lot of promise. Things such as restorative justice initiatives, things like social and emotional learning, things like positive behaviors, interventions, and supports. All of those different programs and initiatives create more positive school climates and environments in which students and teachers and students learn to trust one another better. They have better relationships, and that's what we find is really creating safe school environments, not the police officers, not the metal detectors.
Sandra, thanks so much for your call. Let's try to get one more call in here. Steve in Slinger. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Yeah, what would you like to add very quickly?
Yes, I am. I grew up in Milwaukee and went to MPS, and we had police in our school, and it made me feel safer because I was a skinny little white kid. I got pushed around a lot and beat up and chased home every day from school.
Cleef, really quickly, the takeaway here?
I grew up in Milwaukee, so I think Milwaukee is a different situation than Madison. The crime rates in Milwaukee in comparison to the crime rate in here in Madison, I think there's no comparison. That's number one there. But my thing is this, is that we're setting up predominantly children of color to have an early meet with the system. And I think anybody that has a moral conscience or any kind of moral rectitude would see that children don't belong in prison, and we don't need to be setting children up for failure and to have those brushes with the system.
Cleef and Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Cleef Mouab-El, Executive Director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring, and Jason Nance, an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Florida.
This is Central Time.